from the Moen Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. 25 years ago, right around this time of the morning, L.A. was a mess. The Northridge earthquake had jolted us awake to the fact that a lot of our buildings were not as safe as we need them to be. We'll hear if we've gotten better since then. Plus, it's day 27 of the government shutdown. We'll hear if there's any room for compromise from a couple of California congressmen, a Democrat and a Republican. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is January 21st at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. You know, I lived here my whole life, and I'm still amazed how fast people drive when all of this rain is coming down. I'm puttering along the freeway this morning at 45 miles an hour, and people are just blowing past me. Absolutely amazing. Well, it's going to be wet everywhere all day. Rain is expected to last through 5 o'clock tonight. In some places, it is absolutely pouring. Already, parts of Ventura and Santa Barbara counties near the Thomas Fire burn scar have seen about 6 inches of rain in the last 48 hours. The 101 freeway near downtown L.A. has been shut down due to flooding. Roads near Malibu are closed, and mandatory evacuations are still in place for areas affected by the Woolsey and Holy fires. For the latest, check our website, laist.org. That's laist.com, excuse me, laist.com, laist.com. We'll have updates there all day. KPCC Sharon McNary has been on storm watch for us and is currently with L.A. County Public Works in its operations center. Sharon, welcome.
Hey there.
Now, with all this rain, there's a lot of concern it'll trigger mud and debris flow. So far, nothing too major has been reported, thankfully. What can you tell us about the more troublesome spots that are holding up?
Right. So I checked with the command center for the Woolsey Fire. That's out in the steel trailer out in back of the Agoura Hills Sheriff's Station. And, you know, they've got about 300 sheriff's deputies and firefighters and road crew and public works people all working to keep that Woolsey area safe. No big incidents so far, they're saying. However, a car-sized boulder did come down on Stunt Road off Mulholland in that area, kind of between Calabasas and Malibu. I mean, I've ridden my road bike on Stunt Road many times. It's a very steep and curvy road, and, you know, a boulder this size could have taken out an entire peloton of bikes. There are a few closed roads like Malibu Canyon Road, Decker Canyon, Highway 23, but overall the slopes seem to be holding up so far.
And that boulder is gigantic. You sent us a picture. We're going to have a picture of that at Take Two on Twitter. That thing dwarfs the big truck that's behind it. So that thing, man, that if I'm glad that no one got hurt, at least that we know of from that boulder. Now, Sharon, you're at an operations center where people are monitoring all of this very closely. What's the scene there?
Well, I've never been here before, and it's really interesting. There's probably about 50 different, you know, stations with desks and computers, and there's like big TV screens monitoring the various TV channels. But the most interesting is the big TV screen with the rainfall gauge on it. So you could see like individual little micro areas where the rain is falling, and then the Doppler radar on the other side. And they've been pleased with the amount of rain so far, nothing too intense, you know, despite that this is, you know, rain coming from an atmospheric river. But in just about the last hour, they saw it on their giant Doppler radar screen, this big cell of rain that crossed into Malibu. It was a storm cell that had been moving eastward, and they looked like it was headed to Oxnard. But then it swung southward, and it came ashore, and it moved through the Malibu area. And, you know, who knows if that boulder came down because of that. But one of their rain gauges recorded 0.14 inches in just 15 minutes. That's the kind of intensity of rain that makes public works people nervous.
Now, despite all of the potential hazards, Sharon, there is some upside. We need the rain. California's been so dry. What are the latest numbers on how much rain we might have captured?
Well, they actually keep track of it here at Public Works. You know, they keep it in the dams and spreading grounds. So since Monday, visualize 7,500 acre feet. That's a stack of water covering a football field about a mile and a quarter high. 2.4 billion gallons has been captured. That's enough for the water needs of about 60,000 people a year so far, and more will come down out of the mountains.
Now, speaking of that, more rain is supposed to last throughout the day. How vigilant, Sharon, do we need to be?
you know, don't give up, because, you know, the slopes get very saturated. You know, the burn tends to make the mud slide off the hills in a way that it might not. The heavy rain will be moving through the Holy Fire burn areas with the new evacuation orders that came through this morning in the Lake Elsinore area. The rain could be very heavy in the coming hours in Riverside and San Bernardino County areas as the storm heads east. So just don't give up vigilance yet. And, you know, the same fog that caused that 20-car pileup on Interstate 15 yesterday was back this morning. So there's another danger area for you.
That's KPCC Sharon McNary. She's with L.A. County Public Works this morning. Sharon, look out for rocks.
You bet.
All right, let's check in on the LAUSD strike. As protests enter day four, union reps for United Teachers Los Angeles say talks with the district will resume.
Bargaining is going to happen today. We are hopeful that bargaining will continue tomorrow, and we are hopeful that it will continue into the weekend.
That's UTLA President Alex Caputo-Pearl at a news conference this morning. Negotiations will start this afternoon, and KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes is here with the very latest. Hello, Kyle.
Morning, A.
Now, this afternoon's meeting is going to be facilitated by the office of Mayor Eric Garcetti. His office has been quietly talking to both sides for some time now. How did this meeting come to be?
Well, the mayor offered way back in August to be a mediator in this dispute if it would be helpful. But in recent weeks, I would say the mayor has been getting a little bit more involved with his office. First of all, trying to facilitate the last minute talks that took place last week leading up to the ultimate moment where the union walked out and said, essentially, we're probably going to go on strike on Monday. They initially that those last minute talks were sort of planned to take place at LA City Hall, which gives you an indication that the mayor was involved for that as well. But in recent days, the mayor has been sort of acting as this go-between between the two sides, urging both to get back to the table. And so in recent days, it seemed very tentative. It seemed very tentative last night when word started to trickle out that this meeting was even going to happen. And it didn't really feel real until we got a statement from the mayor's office finally confirming just in a few lines that these talks were in fact on.
Yeah, Mayor Garcetti told us a few days ago that he would not announce any intention to run for president until the strike was over. So I don't know. I'm wondering how much does that have to do with him trying to get himself involved in that. Now, yesterday, UTLA President Alex Caputo-Pearl said he was going into the meetings with a lot of hope. That's a bit of an abrupt change of tone, isn't it, for him?
A very abrupt change of tone. In fact, a change of tone in the span of about 12 hours or so, because about 12 hours before he gave this very optimistic press conference, as you said, saying we might be able to talk through the weekend. There was none of the sort of, you know, venom that he was spewing earlier in the day toward Superintendent Austin Buettner. He was very, angry, and it seemed kind of personal. He
called him a liar, right? He basically called,
Right. And so it was a very, the departure in tone, I thought, was really notable. Caputo-Pearl yesterday, I thought, sounded very optimistic. And there was none of the sort of, kind of drumbeat that I think we've heard and gotten used to hearing about how, the school district is not on the side of kids and families that we hear from Caputo-Pearl at most of his recent press availabilities. That was dialed down significantly. The optimism was at a 9 out of 10. I don't know if that portends a change in this process.
Now, another thing Mayor Garcetti told us on Monday is that he said the goals of the district and UTLA are not very far from each other. Where does Mayor Garcetti see room for compromise?
Well, I think part of the thing that he said was that the two sides in confidence, in private meetings, is what he said on Monday, express, that they are not that far apart. And so the deal. So there may be conversations he's having that we're not privy to that describe that the two sides are closer together. But from their public statements and from the conversations I'm having, there are some issues on which the two sides are really, really far apart. And so I'm kind of confused by the mayor's assessment that this is going to be an easy problem to fix. When you look at, you know, for instance, the central sticking point of class size reduction, you're talking about a problem there about not only how much the district should spend, not only about how much the district has put money on the table right now, but also about how much power the district should have and how much the teachers in response should have. And that requires a little bit of you know, standing a mutual trust between the two sides. And we've got ample evidence in recent days that that trust, you know, is very, very thin. Yeah. And so So who knows? You know, maybe the mayor is hearing something that I'm not behind closed doors.
And you've written about this on LAist.com that Eric Garcetti is walking a bit of a tightrope here, that fundamental distrust is there between the two camps. Any president that tells you that maybe having an intermediary will be the key to breaking the impasse?
I do think there has been an increasing feeling, especially among the district in recent days, that they need the help of a third party, a new adult in the room, so to speak, to try and moderate this dispute. And so I think that there is openness from that perspective to having them involved, to having another person involved. But as you say, you know, it's a tightrope for Garcetti because he's walking into a very complicated dispute. He's not been very involved in education matters previously. And so is going to have to engage with some of these really sticky, thorny issues that go way down into the weeds of how a school district functions. The mayor got involved in the port strike in 2015. That's why he offered to get involved here. So he's been around this block before and has experience in these tough labor negotiations. But now he wasn't rumored to be considering a bid for president back in 2015. Now he is, and the spotlight is really on him.
KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes. Kyle, keep it up.
Thanks, A.
In addition to interrupting classes, the teacher strike has put a stop to many after-school activities, including sports. Student-athletes have not been able to practice at school or participate in any games because many of their coaches are on the picket line. Ethan Anderson is a senior at Fairfax High School and a point guard on the basketball team.
Now we're just left to be able to practice, just player-ran practice when we can. And that's been tough because, like, not everyone on the team lives by each other. Like, some people live an hour away from each other. So we're trying to find a neutral location where both people can meet in the middle. And, like, the teams that we're going to play that are not affected by the strike, they're going to have an upper hand on us because we're not even able to get actual team practices in. So it's been tough.
Anderson says he hasn't been going to classes, and most of his teammates haven't either. He says they want to show support for the teachers who are on strike. Plus, he doesn't think they'll be learning anything.
As me, I'm a senior. A lot of people on my team are. We don't want our senior season to cut short or end like this when it's completely out of our control.
Anderson says he's frustrated about missing classes, but for students on a nationally ranked basketball team, just like Fairfax, not participating in sports can have a negative effect on future opportunities, things like scholarships.
Our education comes first, but as for kids on the team that are trying to earn scholarships, athletic scholarships, opportunities are being taken away because, like, we're supposed to play in two big games this week that we're going to have college scouts there, so those are chances for us to better our future and be able to go to college for free through basketball. It's not that we're just worried about the basketball aspect of it. This has an effect on our whole future and everything we've been working for up to this point. So, yeah, this strike can affect people on a lot of different levels.
That's Fairfax High School senior Ethan Anderson. Anderson tells us he's already committed to play basketball at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, but he knows the strike means his teammates might not have the same chance to be noticed by a college. All right, to Northridge now. 25 years ago this morning, at approximately 4:30 a.m., L.A. woke up to a 6.7 magnitude earthquake. The shaking only lasted about 10 to 20 seconds, but 57 people died, almost 9,000 were injured, and there was billions of dollars in property damage. I remember the earthquake in vivid detail. I had just transferred to Cal State Northridge in January of 94 and was really looking forward to campus life. Now, to really immerse myself in school, I quit my full-time job as a bank teller, and I was set to work in the campus bookstore. Well, the quake ended that plan. But actually, no complaints from me, because a few weeks later, on the first day of the next job I got, I met my wife. We've been together ever since. All right, what's your Northridge story? Twitter user Alexandra Mockel shared her harrowing experience with us. She was living in Hollywood at the time and had only moved to L.A. 6 months earlier. At first, she thought the delivery trucks at the market next door were being loud. But once she realized what was happening, she spent the night outside with neighbors while helicopters hovered overhead and transformers exploded all around her. Now she says she always knows where her shoes and flashlights are. Tell us your Northridge earthquake tale. You can find us on Facebook. We're at Take Two Show, or on Twitter. We're at Take Two. It is day 27 of this record-setting government shutdown with no end in sight. Now, we know what the president wants, money for a border wall. We know for the Democrats, that's a deal breaker. We'll find out if there's any room for compromise from a couple of California congressmen. First up, Northern California Republican Doug LaMalfa. He's up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start September. Apply by January 21st to be considered for a $4,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Today is the 25th anniversary of the Northridge earthquake. Now, I shared my personal experience about that earlier in the show, but we also reached out to listeners for their stories. Julie Greenberg wrote us on Twitter. She was living in Northridge at the time. She said, quote, "It felt like a bomb, not an earthquake. The building jumped up and down. Everything was so loud. There was a gas leak. The building was condemned. People were hurt. At first, she thought her cat had died, but thankfully, she found her pet in the corner of her bedroom shaking. Her cat lived for another 19 years. All right, listeners, what do you remember from that fateful January day back in 1994? Tell us your Northridge earthquake tale. You can find us on Facebook. We're at Take Two Show, or on Twitter. We're at Take Two. Now, we thought we'd take a moment to talk about how homeowners can prepare their properties in case of another major quake. Misha Youssef is the producer of The Big One, Your Survival Guide. That's KPCC's newest podcast. She joins us now to talk about earthquake insurance as well as bracing and bolting homes. Misha, good to have you back.
Hi, it's great to be back.
All right. Now, a lot of homes in L.A. were built up before engineers even knew how to protect them from major earthquakes. And that means a lot of homes are lacking in what experts say is now needed, retrofit. So what sorts of homes are most vulnerable during an earthquake?
Houses that were built before 1978 are by far the most vulnerable. And of those, there are two different types of houses. So it's soft story wood frame buildings, yeah, and then non-ductile concrete buildings.
Non-ductile concrete buildings, very technical term. Now, okay, so what sort of retrofits then are recommended for different types of buildings?
Yeah, there are two things that you can do, and a few others that are associated with it. So first of all, there's bolting and bracing. So you want to bolt the house down to the foundation, and then you want to brace things like the water heater and the chimney. Some retrofit programs also include things like installing automatic gas shutoff valves to prevent fires in case of an earthquake. And once those things are taken care of, your house is much safer and considered retrofitted.
How much does that cost typically for a single family home, say?
So it totally depends on your house. Mm-hmm. It ranges anywhere from $3,000 to $5,000 for really complex retrofits for homes on hillsides, say. it costs as much as $7,000. The cool thing is that the California Earthquake Authority is offering grants of about $3,000 for single-family homes that qualify, and that's through their program called Earthquake Bolt and Brace. So EBB.com, I believe, is where you can go and apply for those grants.
Now, moving on to earthquake insurance. So there's a sense out there that earthquake insurance is so expensive, Misha, that it's just not worth it. What do you think?
It is really expensive.
Yeah, it is.
It's expensive mostly because homes in California are really expensive, yeah, and it's a high-risk area. That said, the thing to be most wary of when it comes to earthquake insurance is actually your deductible. Hmm. So you want to make sure that whatever insurance you do get, your deductible is an amount that you can pay if there is a worst-case scenario earthquake and your home suffers a lot of damage.
Well, okay, so how does earthquake insurance work exactly? Because I'm thinking, I think the rules changed recently, right? So how does that all work?
Yeah, there are a couple things that happened recently. First of all, the California Earthquake Authority lowered rates by about 50%. So earthquake insurance is much cheaper than it was a few years ago. In addition to that, your deductible, you have a little bit more of a choice. So you don't necessarily have to pay a 25% deductible on the value of your home. Instead, you can choose 5, 10, 20, or 25%. So you have a little bit more leeway in terms of what your out-of-pocket costs will be.
Now, I can already hear, Misha, people doing the mental math on all of these costs that we're talking about with the bolting and retrofitting and then the insurance. Wondering, is it better for people just to do a retrofit, just maybe get only earthquake insurance, or actually try to do all of them?
So if you can afford it, if you can afford it, definitely do everything you possibly can, right? Retrofit your house, get the most coverage you possibly can with the lowest deductible, and make sure that you're safe. But this is a tough question. Money questions are always difficult. So if you are in a spot where it has to be either or, the first thing I recommend is you reach out to a seismic retrofitting expert. There are companies, structural engineers, who focus specifically on this stuff. And they can come to your house for free or a very low cost and assess what your house specifically needs. That said, it's really important to understand that if your house is retrofitted, then your earthquake insurance is also cheaper because your house is now lower risk, right?
Yeah.
Because it's safer pre-earthquake. So there are a lot of factors that go into this. I would definitely talk to an expert and have them assess your specific home before making a decision.
Do we know how many homeowners are without any of those things? Nothing. Are naked almost.
Yeah. So we do know that about a million houses in all of California require retrofitting. Mm. And that number is a little bit slippery because, you know, it's not that easy to figure out how many houses do need retrofitting.
Yeah.
We know that 10% of homeowners in California are insured. And that number is the particularly scary one because that means 90% of people in California in high-risk earthquake territory are not insured.
That is frightening. Misha Youssef is the producer of KPCC's newest podcast, The Big One, Your Survival Guide. She's been speaking with us about how homeowners can prepare their properties in case of another major earthquake. Misha, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, moving on. It is day 27 of a partial government shutdown that has left thousands of federal workers across the country without pay. While President Trump signed legislation yesterday guaranteeing back pay for those workers, Democrats and Republicans in Washington seem no closer to making a deal that would restore full government operations. The continued shutdown is having an increasingly negative effect on people and services that depend on federal aid, people just like farmers. You'll find a lot of them in Congressional District Number 1 in Northern California. Republican Doug LaMalfa is congressman there. He told me Tuesday that he's received a mixed response from constituents.
You know, everybody wants us to get this thing over with as soon as possible. But, you know, what's interesting is many will take you aside personally, say, you know what, I think what you're trying to do, whether it's me or the president or whoever they're chalking up the credit to on border security, you know, you guys need to get that done too. So many will tell you, like, hey, we can weather this for a while. There's even some federal employees that are quietly saying this too. We can weather this for a while if you guys can get this done. So it's a mixture, definitely, because nobody wants us to be in this position here. We would like to have everything operational. So my question is, when the president has invited the leadership of both houses of both parties to come to the White House and, you know, sit down and say, what do we need to do?
When it comes to those concerns, though, Congressman, we're going to get to border security in just a little bit. So what are some of those specific concerns that you're hearing about?
Well, I'm hearing it mostly in the media. They're not rattling my phones so much on all that at home. But again, it's been a bit of a balance, too. So,
but are there no farmers that have come to you with concerns about this shutdown dragging on?
Yeah, so far it's turning into an inconvenience, but it hasn't been devastating to anybody that's called us yet.
Talking to Republican Congressman Doug LaMalfa. So let's get into that shutdown a bit. President Trump has continued to demand over $5 billion for the border wall. Democrats have said no. And in the past, you've expressed support for a wall, among other border security measures. Do you think that the president is right to hinge so much, Congressman, on getting this wall funded?
When will it ever happen if a stand isn't made for this? Because Reagan was promised it in 86. Border wall funding has happened a couple other times. Leading Democrats make passionate speeches about this, yet when it comes down to executing on it, they leave it pretty short. So it's an important thing. But this isn't the president's deal. This is what is recommended by his border security forces as well.
But it is his deal. He's owning this shutdown because of his desire to fulfill this campaign promise.
The situation is, Lucy's been fooling the football away from presidents and Republicans for a lot of years on this border security. Yes, President Trump has made it a cornerstone, but this is based on the recommendations of the people at the border that know what need to be done. And we need border forces, we need, the personnel, we need different types of monitoring technology, but also we need some area of it to have a sturdy fence that will do the job.
So just to be clear, Congressman, you're okay. You're good with having this shutdown go as long as it needs to, as long as the wall gets the funding.
No, you're
needs.
Putting words in my mouth there. Okay?
Well, I'm asking.
Get this shutdown over with here, okay? But we need to have a negotiation. And the Democrats so far are saying no, nothing, when just not that long ago they at least had a number out there. Now they've thrown down and said we're just going to ride this out as well. So, why don't they get the same question? Like, are they willing to go forever in order to not do border security?
Does the wall have to get the funding it needs for this shutdown to end?
Well, I think the president is pretty adamant about what we send up to the White House is going to have something in that, or it doesn't get past the Senate, So Mitch McConnell said we're not sending over there, it doesn't get signed. So it's kind of a deal where right now you have a different majority in the House that's willing to send a lot of things over, but this is something that we took care of in December with the House measure that did go over to the Senate, and it got waylaid over there because they couldn't get 9 Democrat votes at the time. So you want to blame one side, but both sides could have some level of shouldering of being at odds on this issue.
When it comes to a fair compromise, though, what does that look like to you?
$2.5 billion, $3 billion, pick a number.
I'm not the one voting, so I'm wondering for you, what does a fair compromise look like to you?
A negotiation.
Leading to
some border security and some of the stuff what the Dems want. Each side takes something and you build on that.
Two more things. Earlier this month, President Trump tweeted that he's asked FEMA to stop sending money to California. He also blamed the state's fires on poor forest management. Coming from a fellow Republican, what's your reaction to that tweet?
I wasn't very pleased with that tweet because the problem with that, it was conflating two different issues. The poor management we do have of federal forests and the difficulty it is in California, extreme difficulty. I was an 8-year legislator in the state before I came here, of advancing forest management practices and legislation to ease the ability to do so is extremely difficult in California. We got more lawyers per square inch in California than anywhere in the world. They're all anxious to sue over the slightest thing, even timber salvage after a fire. They sue over that and delay it for months and months and make it almost useless to do the salvage after the fire at that point, and much more expensive. So there's really not a lot of good sense that gets applied within our state towards forest management because of how beholden Sacramento is to a handful of environmental groups. But you have, again, the usual roadblocks from people suing and the U.S. Forest Service being caught in its tracks there. But I have no doubt they will continue to push forward and try to do more to manage and thin, forest lands that they have and not kowtow and give up ahead of time, surrender even before the battle from environmental groups saying no to any kind of forest management.
Now, one last question. You've been quoted in the past saying that you don't buy the idea of human-made climate change. This past year, we saw at least two major reports, one from NOAA and one from the UN. Both made the case that climate change is real and a driving factor behind all the wildfires that we saw
from the UN. You cite the UN?
Well, from NOAA and the UN. I'm just adding two different places.
NOAA changed some figures a couple of years ago on one of their studies there because they wanted to change the model in order to fill the gaps, in order to fill what...
The report still came out, and I'm wondering, given...
Well, I could make a report come out. Now, what are you talking about?
You're not a scientist. You're a farmer.
Farmers know a lot, too. You know, they know have a lot more sense than a lot of people running government, I'll tell you that.
Aside from all that, given what's transpired, is it possible in your mind...
You're good.
Is it possible, Congressman, in your mind that climate change could be making these fires more severe as the years go on?
You know what, the climate changes all the time, right? Now, how much of it do you want to attribute to being man-made, and how much is it by things that are happening in nature naturally, okay? And what country is doing the most if the whole thing hinges on CO2? The U.S. has moved faster on lowering CO2 numbers as a percentage than anywhere else in the world. We have the cleanest running automobiles and power plants, and we're always working to strive to do things even better. So the whole climate change argument comes down to is a bunch of people trying to figure out who to tax and who to regulate in the United States, and then use those tax dollars to go chase frivolous things like the high-speed rail project, which is over a $100 billion boondoggle now. So,
just wondering if there was a slight chance in your mind that that could be the reason for the fires.
What I'll give you is that we strive to do things better all the time. Cleaner burning equipment, automobiles, power plants, all those things. But at the end of the point is that mankind, in order to live, has to heat things in order to stay warm, to produce food. So when the United States is leading the way on producing things cleaner and better, then we're going to get sooner to whatever tiny percentage that is. But when we're talking just a tiny amount of parts per billion of the whole atmosphere, I don't think it's mankind that's causing climate change. It may have a tiny portion of the influence, but there's a lot of other factors at work. So for people to run around and say the science is settled is people with an agenda that basically want to tax and regulate the United States to have some kind of different outcome.
Congressman Doug LaMalfa represents California's 1st District in Northern California. Congressman, thank you very much.
It's been interesting, eh?
Okay, we just heard a Republican take on the shutdown. Up next, we head down to Southern California for a Democratic perspective. Congressman Mike Levin will tell us what he thinks it'll take to get the government open again. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change, because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Ever wondered why we have KPCC's signature local news shows, Take Two and Air Talk, back-to-back in the mornings? Yeah, we were wondering too. Now, we're making sure you get all the Southern California news you need in the mornings and in the afternoons. We're moving Take Two to 2 p.m. That's starting next Tuesday. And at 9 a.m., we think you'll enjoy the national news show, The Takeaway, with Tanzina Vega. The Takeaway, weekday mornings at 9, Take Two at 2. It is day 27 of the partial government shutdown with no end in sight. Now, we just heard from Republican Congressman Doug LaMalfa in District 1. Now, let's hear from a Democrat. Congressman Mike Levin represents District 49 in northern San Diego County and southern Orange County. He says the effects of the shutdown are being felt in his district.
Yeah, we have a Fish and Wildlife office in Carlsbad. About 50 people were impacted there, and many of them are younger and don't have savings. And as you know, Southern California is a very expensive place to live, and there aren't a lot of good options for people without pay to be able to just make ends meet if you're living paycheck to paycheck. Just same with a member of the Coast Guard who is still doing their job and ironically preventing drugs from entering the country. And Coast Guard does their job extraordinarily well. So how can one be for border security and trying to prevent drugs from entering the country, but not want to pay the Coast Guard? The other thing that's important is that each of the bills that we have voted on over the last couple of weeks, we have voted to reopen the government. These are all bills that the Republicans previously agreed to, and in most cases, overwhelmingly supported. The one we did yesterday as an example, the Senate voted 92-6 in support of that bill to reopen part of the government. And yet now they won't even hear it.
Then that's why I got to ask then, what does a compromise look like to you in order to end this shutdown? I've asked that of several lawmakers all this week.
Well, what we have to do is we've got to focus on reopening the government first while we negotiate a border security package that leads to a safe border, more effective security measures, things like ports of entry, better screening, better technology.
So that's the line in the sand, right, Congressman? Opening the government first before moving on.
We have to, because what we are doing is setting a very dangerous precedent if we allow the government to be shut down every time this president has a temper tantrum, because we've got a lot of things coming up in the next 2 years. We've got many times where, you know, there will be disagreements between Democrats and Republicans. You've got Democrats in charge of the House, Republicans still in charge of the Senate. Obviously, you've got a Republican in the White House, so there will be points of disagreement. We cannot allow the government to be shut down. We cannot allow the federal workforce to be held hostage every time a disagreement comes up.
We're talking to Congressman Mike Levin. He represents District 49 in northern San Diego County and southern Orange County. Specifically, Congressman, what does border security look like to you?
Well, I think there are a lot of things that we can come together and do that are smart and effective. You know, obviously, technology plays a big part of this. We need to install new scanners to, you know, at our ports for commercial and passenger vehicles, for drugs, and make sure that we stop other contraband. You know, the reality is that you hear a lot about drugs pouring through the border, but according to the DEA and others who are involved, about 90% of the drugs being smuggled into the U.S. are seized at the official ports of entry, not areas between the ports of entry where the president wants to build the border wall. So if you want to get, you know, better security against drugs, beef up the technology at the ports of entry. We also need better technology to detect the unauthorized crossings. So things like cameras and sensors, radar, so you can spot moving people in any weather that are, you know, mounted on towers and vehicles, and we can use drones as well.
The thing I'm not hearing, though, is a wall, because when I spoke to Republican Congressman Doug LaMalfa from Northern California, he pointed out that Democrats have voted on border barriers before with the Secure Fence Act of 2006 that led to 700 miles of fencing. At the heart of it, Congressman, are Democrats opposed to additional barriers, or is this more about denying President Trump the win and fulfilling his campaign promise?
Well, what this is about is not spending billions of taxpayer dollars, and people talk about $5 billion, that's just to get it started, on an ineffective and expensive wall that can be tunneled under, be climbed over, be cut through, and let's not forget Mexico was supposed to pay. And I honestly believe that this president needs to stop holding the health and safety and paychecks of the American people hostage.
But how do we square the Democrats have voted on barriers in the past, have voted for barriers in the past?
Well, we voted for smart and effective barriers, not for the unnecessary and wasteful barrier that the president is proposing now. There is a big difference between what we've supported in the past and what is being proposed today. And it's false equivalence. And his own party overwhelmingly rejected just last year. Remember, they were in control of the House, the Senate, and the White House the last 2 years. And at every turn, they rejected building this type of wall. He only had the support of about a quarter of his own party among those elected in the House and the Senate to build this sort of barrier. So if it was that big of a deal, they would have done it the last 2 years. They're playing politics now. They've waited for Democrats to take control of the House. They want to make it an issue in the 2020 campaign. And they're playing politics with people's lives. It needs to stop.
Well, I'll ask this question then the same way I posed it to your colleague, Congressman LaMalfa. Are Democrats willing to keep this shutdown going until the border wall is off the table?
We have voted every day and will continue to vote every day to reopen the government. That's what we want to do. I want nothing more than to be able to, the next time I'm home in Southern California, be able to have a fully functioning federal government so that the good men and women who are federal employees or contractors are being paid and doing their jobs.
If the wall is on the table, it's not going to happen.
We are not going to support an unnecessary wall when all evidence suggests that it's a political gimmick, not an actual solution.
But if it got people in your district paid again, got their paychecks, would it make sense to maybe try and compromise with the president on this?
Well, what makes sense is to flesh it out in coming weeks after having reopened the government. Again, it is that slippery slope. If you shut the government down every time the president has a temper tantrum, every time the president wants to divide a wedge between Democrats and Republicans, that creates a horrible precedent. We cannot shut the government down every time there is political disagreement. We will have those disagreements, and we actually have to have a sensible conversation and try to work together, try to work across the aisle and get things done, not shut the government down every time we have a disagreement. It is the wrong course. We cannot allow it to happen. There's, again, people's lives being impacted every day. I'm mindful of it, and we've got to go forward and do the right thing.
One last thing, Congressman. What are you most concerned about as the shutdown drags on?
The human toll that it's taking and security toll that it's taking. When you start talking about things like members of our Coast Guard who are incredibly important going without pay, or air traffic controllers or TSA agents who are really important for the security of our air travel, we can't play around with security. And ultimately, I hope that common sense prevails when it comes to the security of the American people, if in fact that's the objective of the president.
Mike Levin represents District 49 in northern San Diego County and southern Orange County. Congressman, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A. Always happy to be on.
All right, you just heard a Republican and Democratic perspective on what it might take to end the shutdown. Earlier in the show, we heard the latest on the teacher strike. They'll be back at the negotiating table today. It got me wondering which will end first, the shutdown or the strike. I've got a poll up on my Twitter feed, AMartinezLA. That's AMartinezLA. More Take Two coming up. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Coming up next week, we'll have a new installment of our series. It's called 88 Cities. Our mission is to find out what's unique about every one of the cities in L.A. County. And our tour guides are you. We'll be visiting Glendale soon. You'll hear that next Thursday. But before that, let's revisit a place we checked out last year. Today, Cerritos. Now, to get there, just go north of Disneyland on the 5 for a few miles, and it's basically right there on your left. Before 1967, it was actually called Dairy Valley, and that's because, you guessed it, hundreds of dairies used to be there. But today, KPCC listener Christina Chang wants to show me what's there to love now about Cerritos, her home. Christina, thanks for having us out here.
All right, thanks for having me.
All right, so I think for the average Southern California, and I say, okay, Cerritos, first things that come to your mind, they'll say Auto Square.
There's so much to do in Cerritos, not just the Auto Square. We have Korean and Chinese, as well as a great Indian and Filipino community. And just standing here, I mean, we are outside a Taiwanese bakery. And right next to us is a Korean barbecue house. And right across from us, you could get sushi, you could get Thai curry. There are plenty more plazas just like this. Mm-hmm. Right across the street, another plaza. You name it, we've got it.
Christina, why is this diversity so important to you?
Because it really goes to show that we are such a diverse state, and Cerritos is kind of a microcosm of that.
All right, Christina, so you brought us to a place where there's a ton of food. Are we going to eat?
Yes.
Perfect. Let's go inside.
All right, so we can take a look at the 85C. Yes, this is a Taiwanese bakery. Walnut sesame bread, coconut raisin tarts, Hokkaido cheese tarts, Boro Danish, or Bolo Mianbao in Chinese. So now we're here at Gen Korean Barbecue. There's various items that you could get here. Pork bulgogi, Hawaiian steak, sunsunabu, which is a spicy tofu stew with vegetable and dried shrimp.
Awesome,
so we're entering Sakitumi. They've got just about every type of sushi roll you could think of. Hawaiian, crispy yellowtail, rainbow. We're out right outside the claws. We don't just have Asian food here. You could also get some Cajun seafood. So let's take a look inside. All right, it looks like you could get the captain's catch seafood, like crawfish, snow crab, king crab, dungeness crab, clams and mussels and shrimp. We are inside the Class 302. It's a Taiwanese restaurant. If you're an immigrant from Taiwan, it will literally feel like you're stepping back into the third grade. Personally, I love the oyster pancake or oyster omelet. If you're feeling adventurous, you could try the stinky tofu.
All right, we're back outside. Christina, I mean, here there's so many different kinds of food from all kinds of different Asian countries. Why do you think Cerritos in particular is such a hub for Asian immigrants?
It's central location. I know that's a primary reason why my parents moved here. If we want authentic Chinese food, in less than 30 minutes, we could get to Hacienda Heights or Monterey Park and also shop at Chinese supermarkets as well.
All right, Christina, so you put us in a food coma for our first stop in our tour of Cerritos. Now we're going to head over to our next location.
All right, let's go.
I'm with KPCC listener Christina Cheng, who's showing off her town of Cerritos as part of our series 88 Cities. Christina, where are we now?
We are now at the Cerritos Air Disaster Memorial, this sculpture. On the right side, we see a white marble wing-like piece, and on the left-hand side, we see a gray piece, also wing-like in shape.
And why is this spot here? What is this spot?
So in August 1986, there was a small single-engine plane that clipped the tail of an Aeromexico jetliner. And the small plane landed in an empty playground in Cerritos Elementary, but the larger plane crashed into Holmes Avenue in a residential area, killing 15 people. Everyone on board of both planes perished, and you can see their names here in the sculpture garden, memorialized in this Cerritos Air Disaster Memorial.
I remember that. That was 1986, as you mentioned. And I remember that because it was on a Sunday, right, no one was at the elementary school, and people were at church or they were somewhere else because it was a weekend. So, I mean, as terrible as the disaster was, it could have been really worse.
It could have, yes. It was a Sunday morning, and there are people alive today because they were at church or at the grocery store, but their families were at home, and they unfortunately perished in this disaster.
Growing up here, how much did you hear about this plane crash?
I do feel this might be part of a forgotten history in a sense. I mean, if you were in Cerritos at the time, there's no way you could forget what happened. But a lot of our population now, a lot of younger people, people who have moved here, and this is a part of a history that not everybody knows about.
Why do you think it's important for people to remember this?
Because several of our members of our community perished in this air disaster. And also, this event helped us pass legislation in the United States to make flights safer.
All right, Christina, one more stop on this tour of Cerritos. Which direction should we go?
All right, so we would turn right from the sculpture garden, and you can't miss it. It's the one place you definitely have to visit if you come to Cerritos.
All right, let's go. All right, Christina, where are we now?
We are now at the Cerritos Library.
And this place looks amazing from the outside. Let's go inside.
The first thing you notice when you walk in is the large saltwater aquarium. Yeah,
and that's gigantic. It's a huge, huge aquarium. I mean, when we walked in, that was the first thing you saw. So, I mean, what do you like about this? Because, I mean, it blew me away just looking at it right off the bat.
To be honest, I feel for Los Cerritos residents, having an aquarium in your library is like a fact of life.
Oh, really?
Because we're
why?
So,
why so?
We're so accustomed to see like a little shark here. And then just walking in, you know, the first thing that you're going to be greeted with is this aquarium. All right, so now we're going to head to the children's library. So right when you walk in, you make a left.
Oh. And the entrance has big, giant blocks, big leather-bound books. So it's almost as if we're going into a giant's library.
We kind of are.
Yeah,
so
in
let's
a way.
Check it out.
Let's go inside.
Okay, so walking in, you can notice a space shuttle replica right here. We've got a lighthouse over there. And, of course, you can't miss it. That's Stan the dinosaur. It's a fossil replica.
Can't miss him. Tyrannosaurus Rex. Huge. It's life-size. It's actually quite frightening. If you look at it, that's amazing that that's how big it really was.
Archaeological research began its Tyrannosaurus Rex excavation thanks to an amateur paleontologist named Stan Sacrison.
I found this dinosaur.
Why is this here? Normally, this would be in the Natural History Museum, not in a children's library.
Not every library that you can see a fossil replica of a Tyrannosaurus Rex. But I think it really goes to showing the power of books. If you open a book, you can learn more about dinosaurs, you can learn more about the sea, you can learn more about space.
There's a big giant tree right behind Stan.
Yes. So that's the rainforest tree. And if I have it correct, these are actual sounds of the rainforest. So we are entering the Old World Reading Room. This is my favorite part of the library. It kind of looks like an old campus library.
You looks can like see I'd be at the University of Oxford. That's what I would feel like.
You have leather-bound books here. You have a holographic fireplace.
Wait. Holographic fireplace. That's right.
Yeah,
you do. Wow, look at that.
Yeah, you could sit down on the couch, read some books. And the good part is not a lot of people know about it, so don't tell anyone.
All right, Christina, let's head back downstairs to the aquarium area, and we're going to end our tour of Cerritos.
Oh, all right.
All right, we're back at the entrance right in front of this amazing aquarium. Christina, what do you think it says about this city to have a library of this caliber here?
I think it really shows Cerritos prioritizes knowledge. It's a place that showcases our diversity as well. And yeah, I think it's really great that the city decided that the Cerritos Library is going to, it's right next to City Hall and the Sheriff's Station, and that this is going to really be the heart and center of our city.
All right, Christina Chang. So let's leave our audience with a lasting impression of your city. So give Cerritos a slogan. What would you say is the good slogan for people to remember Cerritos by?
I would say Cerritos, it's a world within a city, and it's also a gateway into Southern California.
That's KPCC listener Christina Chang giving us a tour of Cerritos for our series 88 Cities. Christina, thanks a lot for having us out here.
Thanks for coming.
Be a tour guide too. Out of 88 cities in LA County, where do you live? And what makes it unique? And what can you show us on a tour? Tell us by heading to kpcc.org/88cities. All right, that's going to do it for Take Two. We will be back tomorrow morning at 9. Up next, Air Talk with Larry Mantle. Hey, Larry.
Good morning, A. Coming up this Saturday, the third annual Women's March scheduled in Pershing Square, 8:30 in the morning. There have been some controversies around the country over women's marches and whether they're truly representative of the diversity within communities. We'll talk about some of the plans for the event this coming Sunday.
All right, that's Air Talk with Larry Mantle coming up at 10 o'clock. Thanks, Larry.
Thanks, A.